them will go through the grassroots caucus process, as they did last night, and the other half are going to petition onto the ballot and kind of take their message outside that grassroots meat grinder caucus system, and they're going to petition directly onto the ballot. And there's also a pretty closely watched congressional race here in Colorado. Mike Kaufman, the Republican congressman from District 6, a suburb of...
We're going to continue that on another day because our time clock is running out. But thank you so much to Corey Hutchins of the Colorado Independent and Dulce Sanz, Colorado State Director for the Bernie Sanders campaign. Bernie Sanders, who won in Colorado, and Donna Murch of Rutgers University. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, we'll talk about the climate on Wednesday Talk Radio. The time is now 8 o'clock. First, some announcements.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, on Thursday, March 10th at 7 p.m., KBOO at the Clinton will show Salt of the Earth. Based on actual events, this film depicts a strike by Mexican-American mine workers in New Mexico. Against a backdrop of social injustice, a family drama is played out by a miner and his wife. Again, that's Salt of the Earth, Thursday, March 10th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in to KBOO on Tuesday, March 8th from midnight to midnight as we celebrate International Women's Day with 24 hours of programming produced, hosted, and engineered by women. There will be live music, public affairs with a feminist focus, and female DJs playing all kinds of music to celebrate the creativity, variety, and zeal of the women of the world. Again, that's Tuesday, March 8th, from midnight to midnight here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Paul Rowland. Be with you for the next hour. Now, all right, I'm sure everyone wants to talk about what's going on with the elections, and I would like to, too. To tell you the truth, I kind of forgot that Super Tuesday was happening when I started playing this show, but the Trump spectacle, the Hillary show, and the Bernie phenomenon, perhaps fading, perhaps not. I'm sure we will be talking about all that plenty today, tomorrow, and the next day. But what people aren't talking about much is what's going on in the Arctic. And what's happening in the Arctic is, if possible, even more ominous than the possibility of a Trump presidency. And of course, in a way, these things are also connected, as our guest actually talks about in his latest YouTube video, which I have already linked to, and you can on the promo page for this program at kboo.fm, and you can go to it there, and it will be in the archives of this show. Anyway, it's on the risk of abrupt climate change, and we'll hear a brief clip from that video in a few minutes. But first, I'd like to introduce my guest this morning. Paul Beckwith is with the Laboratory for Paleoclimatology and Climatology at the University of Ottawa. He's a part-time professor in climatology there. He's working on his PhD in abrupt climate change. He has an engineering and physics background, so he is on the cutting edge of research into this issue of the utmost importance. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Paul.
Good.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing over in Ottawa this morning?
Good. We have a bit of a snowstorm underway at the moment, which we seem to have every Wednesday since I teach a third-year class, Geographical Approaches to Environmental Issues, starting at 8:30 on Wednesdays. You know, the only worst time spot would be like Friday at 8:30 or Monday at 8:30. You know, it's not a popular spot. I think, like a lot of people, their brains don't really start functioning this early, at least students anyway.
Yeah, you know, I've heard these discussions about actually starting, you know, especially elementary schools and lower schools a little later because, you know, especially developing brains do not function. We sort of force these kids into these strange, unnatural regimens that are not necessarily the most conducive to learning. But that's another subject for another time, a very important one, of course. So, we're going to talk about what's happening in the Arctic, and it is something that may not be on everybody's agenda, and we're hopefully going to learn exactly why it should be a subject of intense conversation. So, with your permission, this is probably what you'd be talking about right now anyway, and you've already said it on this YouTube clip. So, we're just going to hear a few minutes of that, and then we'll get back to you live. Go ahead, Ross.
That just gives you an idea that when we lose the sea ice in the Arctic, the temperature will skyrocket and the oceans will warm, and it'll be that much harder for the sea ice to form when winter comes in the Arctic. So let's say we lose the sea ice this decade. This summer is going to be very, very interesting. It's hard to make a call on, you know, losing it in one particular year, but we're heading towards a blue ocean event. No ice in the Arctic Ocean, just open, dark, open seawater. So let's say this happens by, throw out a number, 2020. You can calculate the additional energy that will be absorbed in the Arctic. You can calculate the latent heat effect. You know, that ice is no longer there to act as a refrigerator for the Arctic, so the warming takes off. So within a few years, say by, you know, so 2020, if that's the first blue ocean event, within 2 years, the duration of that ice loss is over the Arctic Ocean is likely to be 2 or 3 months. So instead of just losing ice in September at the end of the melt season, it'll be gone for August, September, October. Within another few years, it'll be gone. You know, add a month to either side, it'll be gone. We'll have open ocean July, August, September, October, November. And within a decade, we have open Arctic Ocean year-round. The Arctic is a much warmer place. We lose the snow cover. We lose the ice cover, and then the Greenland melt rate, which is doubling right now every 5 to 7 years, will ramp up an order of magnitude over what it's doing now, because Greenland will be perpetually warm year-round, and that will cause great rise of sea level. In fact, if you take Greenland and Antarctic doubling rates to be the 5 to 7 years that we're seeing over the last three decades, you can easily calculate sea level rises approaching 7 meters by 2070. This is not out of the question. This is basic, the math of the exponential function. And I haven't even talked about methane. There's vast amounts of methane in the permafrost and in the sediments on the seafloor. I just attended a Northern Arctic conference, collaboration between U of Ottawa and Carleton. And many presenters were talking about permafrost and features on permafrost and, oh, it affects buildings, it does this or that. Every talk, I put in the question, do you measure methane? There's very cheap devices you can bring up there, and you can measure methane and CO2 coming from the permafrost. And isn't it prudent to measure those things? Because that's a risk to changing the entire climate system. That's a risk to all of humanity. You know, and none of these people are, like, even clue in that these risks are here. You know, these are grad students, right? This happens worldwide. I mean, the IPCC is not recognizing this threat. What are we? Are we in the Twilight Zone? You know, this is an enormous threat to humanity. And people, their brains are not capable of recognizing this threat. Like, it's just unbelievable to me, you know? And this is, you know, a large part of it is the silo effect. Large part of it is people not talking to each other about their research, over-specialization, not considering system thinking. Anyway, it's just unfathomable to me.
Okay, and that was Paul Beckwith on a recent YouTube video, and we have him live on the phone from Ottawa, Canada. We're in the Twilight Zone, huh, Paul?
Yes. It's funny. This is the video where I believe I was just walking down the streets or something home,
yep.
Was it? I can tell from the my voice, you know, you can tell I'm kind of like dodging cars and just kind of keeping aware of where I'm walking. And the other thing is this is the first time I've heard it, because I generally don't listen to my own stuff. So, you know, it sounds better. It sounds actually pretty good. I mean, maybe this was an imposter or something.
No, that it was quite cogent. So I'd just like to go back to the beginning of that video. You're talking about you know, the loss of sea ice and a blue ocean event. I'm sure some of our listeners are familiar with it. Before that, you'd kind of gone into an explanation of how if you look at a cubic centimeter or whatever of ice, and when the energy it takes to melt that, and then you compare it to the energy, that same energy melting applied to a cubic of water, it raises it to 80 degrees as an explanation. So take us back to this blue ocean event and connect it to what's happening in the Arctic right now. Tell about what is going on in the Arctic right now.
Okay, so the Arctic is getting a lot darker. So in the summer, when the solar radiation, so the Arctic summer, the boreal summer, you know, above the Arctic Circle, it's daylight 24 hours a day. And then, of course, in the winter, it's dark 24 hours a day. But during the summer, the Arctic surface is, because the sea ice extent is declining rapidly, in fact, you know, the trend is almost exponential, you have this very white, you know, ice. You know, thick ice is quite white, especially if it's got fresh snowfall on it. It reflects 90% plus of the incoming solar radiation, and that keeps it cool, the region cool. So now, as there's less and less Arctic Ocean being covered, you have the dark ocean underneath, and that absorbs 90% of the incoming solar radiation. It only reflects 10%. The term is the albedo is 10%, which is the 90%. So this dark ocean absorbs most of the heat energy, and that heats the ocean, which further contributes to melting the ice in a reinforcing feedback loop. And it takes a lot of energy to melt ice. As you know, if you have ice cubes in a glass, the temperature at the surface of the water next to the ice is 0 degrees Celsius, you know, or just slightly above 0 degrees Celsius. And as it stays there as long as there's some ice. And as soon as the ice is gone, then the temperature starts rising very rapidly. And this is because it takes, you know, a tremendous amount of energy to melt ice versus to heat water. So this so-called latent heat effect is a big positive reinforcing feedback. Now, most people, when they think of the Arctic changing, they think of the sea ice declining. But it turns out that the sea ice decline in the summer is something like 12 to 13% per decade since the satellite record started in 79. But since that time period, the loss of snow cover on the land in the Arctic regions, you know, like Siberia, for example, northern Canada, the decline of snow cover is down about almost double the rate at which the ice is back. So the ice is going 13%, 12-13% per decade. The snow cover is down 22% per decade. So in this case, the white snow, which reflects 90% of the sunlight, you know, older snow would be 80% maybe. When it's gone, you have the permafrost underneath, the darker permafrost, that will absorb a lot more of the solar radiation. And then when the permafrost starts thawing out, it's full of organic matter. And when it starts thawing out, the bacteria can attack that organic matter, break it down, and produce either CO2 if it's right near the surface and there's oxygen available, or methane if it's a bit further down. So the methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. So the Arctic is very important to the overall climate system.
Mm-hmm. Are you still there?
So yeah, okay. Yes, I'm still here. You may have heard the expression, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. It's not like Las Vegas. And actually, I lay claim to that expression. I'm the first one that used it. It was during an interview 3 or 4 years ago. And it's funny because the person that was interviewing me said, hey, that's great. I mean, I just thought of it sort of during the interview. And he said, oh, you should trademark it, or, you know, make sure people know it's yours. And I, right. And it's funny because John Kerry, in his speech in Paris at the COP21, he gave a speech. It was supposed to be 50 minutes. It was about half an hour. Really good, talking about the threat of climate change to, you know, the stability of the U.S., to the stability of the world. You know, it's a huge threat multiplier. And he used the first part of that. He said, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. And the head of NASA used it a few months earlier. And it does pop up from time to time. Every time I hear it, I kind of chuckle.
So obviously there's some people who are getting it. You know, there's a lot of intelligent people out there. There's certainly a fair number of people who are actually paying attention to this. Yet there seems to be this bizarre lag time. I mean, obviously, we understand why that lag time exists if we really study it in terms of, you know, the inability of institutions, you know, the resistance from corporate interests, from the financial sector, from powerful political forces, et cetera. We understand all that, but as you said, you know, your phrase, "Are we in the twilight zone?" The cognitive dissonance between the pace of what's happening in the Arctic, the actual reality of what is actually happening on planet Earth, and the ability of us to react to that is utterly striking and utterly frightening. And you know, the purpose of a program like this is not to frighten people. It is unclear exactly, you know, what the best steps to take are. But you certainly have not given up all hope, and you're obviously continuing to study it and to talk about it. So, and we are here on KBOO too. So in the spirit of that, and to continue talking as you are about, you know, what's going on in the Arctic. And so let's go a little deeper. So what, you know, you talked about abrupt climate change. You talk about these feedback loops. You talk about it's not just the permafrost. It's also, you know, methane from the clathrates. What are they called?
Methane clathrates. Yes, yeah. Methane clathrates or methane hydrates that are deep in the ground. So yes, I think the key thing is if all of this was happening in the Arctic and there wasn't a change in weather statistics where people live in the lower latitudes, mostly in the northern hemisphere, right? That's where most of the land masses are. Then, you know, people would not be concerned. We wouldn't reach the level of awareness on what's happening, because the key thing to remember is that what drives weather patterns and what drives air movement in the atmosphere and movement in the oceans is transfer of heat. So the equator, of course, is warm. The pole is cold. This heat tries to move from the equator to the pole in both the atmosphere and oceans. And in the atmosphere, about two-thirds of it moves in the atmosphere because the air moves a lot faster than the ocean. So But because the Earth is rotating, the air, any air moving in the northern hemisphere is deflected to the right, and this generates a strong west to east. This and the convergence of, you know, you start losing space as you go up into the Arctic and the pole, and this concentrates these winds, and you get these high altitude winds we call the jet streams. So they exist because of that temperature gradient from the equator to the Arctic. So as the Arctic is warming at rates 5 to 8 times faster than the rest of the planet, and even faster compared to the equator, then those jet streams start slowing down, and when they slow down, they become wavier and get affected more by the land-ocean contrast. So think of the jet stream as a wall between the cold, dry Arctic air and the warm, moist, more southerly air. So if it's just running west to east, then once you, as you go north, it gets colder. But because these things have these big waves, in the trough of the wave, it's cold and dry Arctic air, and in the crest of the wave, it's the warm air. So we're seeing these patterns. So this is changing the complete statistics of our weather pattern. So the Arctic is affecting, it causes extreme weather events to increase in frequency, severity, and duration. So droughts last a long time, like think of the California drought. We get torrential rain events, you know, 6 months of rain in a night or two in a city, flood your estate, like Colorado a few years ago, or the flooding in Calgary, or the flooding in Toronto, or the flooding in, you know, southern cities. So as the Arctic warms more and more, and we lose sea ice, then these weather extremes are going to take off. There's going to be way more of them than there are today. There's going to be much more severe ones, and this wreaks havoc on infrastructure, on crops. I think the biggest impact will be the global food supply will be hit hard. Prices will go way up. So there's huge economic costs of all this, and this was not anticipated. It was not anticipated. You need to have systems thinking and look sort of at the overall system and how the pieces fit together.
Well, you mentioned the difficult, you know, in that video clip, you were talking about the silo effect and the fact that people aren't talking to each other across disciplines is one of the fundamental obstacles towards really getting this. And the, you know, the rise of systems thinking is really a relatively recent thing in the, you know, the sciences. You know, people think of chaos theory, which is really does grow out of that, which is basically just the complex interactions of many subsystems leading to these, you know, nonlinear effects, as it were. But so obviously that's a big part of, must be a big part of the studies that you're doing. And it's difficult to get any kind of science education out there in, you know, the popular, you know, into the popular sphere, yeah, let alone such complex ones. So I really admire you for doing what you're trying to do, and even using, you know, modern social media like YouTube. It's really important. But so to get to that, you know, a little deeper again into that, the complexity theory of this stuff, I was talking to Robert Hunsaker, who's been talking to you for a while. He's the person who turned me on to you, and by the way, he wrote a recent piece called "The Arctic Turns Ugly," which can be found on Counterpunch as well as other places, which kind of synthesizes a lot of the stuff that we're talking about. I really recommend. Anyway, I just put to him sort of this flash I had the other night in thinking about this. I was thinking, okay, so you've got, you know, we had the polar vortex, what, like last year, right? Which was these unprecedented climatic, you know, weather occurrences that really shook people up to some extent. But then I started thinking, okay, that seems to be due. I started thinking, okay, the if you look at the globe, I think the way I look at it is a really nutshell way of looking at climate and complexity theory. You think of, it's affected by land masses, you know, mountains, and then of course forests and vegetation, all the other, you know, biotic things that are going on, vegetation, and then you've got the oceans, of course, but you've got the polar ice caps. So you've got, you know, and that just drastically simplifies it. But the currents, and then the as you say, the polar ice caps, and the seasonal shrinkage and expansion of sea ice affect both currents, ocean currents, and the air currents. And so,
yes,
that's in a really, really nutshell. But so then, if you think about the, you know, what's happening is this dramatic, you know, you've got this long period of relative stability. Of course, you've got mini ice ages over the past thousands of years. You know, you've got oscillations. You've got this relative stability since the last ice age of the rate of shrinkage and increase. Okay, so if you've, now it's changing. So you've got this.
Right, right. Yes.
So, go ahead.
Yep. I was just going to say that, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the orbital geometry of the Earth around the Sun has these long cyclical changes, like the ellipticity. I mean, sometimes the Earth is orbiting the Sun in almost a circle. Other times it's like a football shape. And the tilt of the Earth is changing over a different period of different cycle. And then the axes of the Earth, the axes over which the Earth is spinning, points to the North Star now, and that fluctuates around, points different places over time. So there's all these cycles, and when you add them all together, you get a change in the solar radiation reaching the Earth in a cyclical pattern, sort of, but it's three cycles combined together. So you get these, periods, these warm periods, cold periods and things. These are long-term changes. But once the solar radiation changes and feedbacks kick in and bring you over, so like a difference of 5 degrees in North America is the difference between, you know, 2 or 3 kilometers of ice over us and what we have now. So you can look at, these are called paleo records, if you like, and you can look at ice cores and in ice caps in Greenland and Antarctica. Greenland gives you data going back 120,000 years. Antarctica, almost 800,000 years, almost 1 million years. Then you go to marine sediments to go back even further. You can go to tree rings to go to more recent stuff. And then you combine all these so-called proxies together, and you get information on the past temperatures and atmospheric concentrations of things like CO2 and methane over time. And you can see these cycles. And basically what we're doing now is the rate of change now of things like CO2 rise, temperature change, ocean pH change, acidity, these things are happening 10, 20 times, maybe 40 times faster than any other period in geologic history. And the other thing is that the temperature can change. The temperature is measured in ice cores on Greenland shows temperature rise varying between 5 degrees Celsius and as high as 16 degrees Celsius. And that change is recorded over the space of 1 or 2 decades. So it's very conceivable that if we, you know, lose sea ice and then snow cover and then Greenland starts taking off and the feedbacks kick in and the Arctic is much warmer, we're basically, this will change global temperatures, could change them 5 or 6 degrees in a decade or two. So the idea of keeping the temperature to 1.5 or 2 degrees from Paris just, it seems like it's out part of the twilight zone. I mean, you can talk to just about any climate scientist and they would argue that we've already, you know, we're already pushing those limits. I mean, look at the December 2015 temperature compared to previous Decembers. We've already had a 1.5 degree rise almost just for that 1 month. So what do we do about it? I mean, solutions. I think I'm optimistic. I think there are solutions. I don't think we have any time to waste. I think it's an emergency situation. And I like to use an analogy I call a metaphor I came up with called the three-legged bar stool. So what this bar stool is leg one is we have to zero fossil fuel emissions as fast as possible. We have to get them to zero, and we can do that. It's a political issue. It's not a technology issue. Renewables are growing in leaps and bounds. Energy efficiency can be greatly increased. We can do things a lot better. So this is leg one, and this is what Paris was all about. But that's not sufficient. the changes underway have built up momentum, and we need to do leg two and three. So leg two, I say, is, I would argue, was of the greatest importance compared to legs two and three. But leg two is we have a huge risk. If the Arctic warms sufficiently, you know, tips over into a different state, then emissions of CO2 and methane from the seafloor and the land will dwarf all human emissions. In other words, we could have methane coming out and CO2 coming out so that all of our human emissions since the start of the Industrial Revolution are dwarfed by a factor of 10 or 20. There's that much carbon in locked in the Arctic. So I've been saying for a long time that we need to look at methods to cool the Arctic. So I'm talking about solar radiation management methods. I think the best is creating low-level marine clouds so that at the edge of the ice. So the low-level marine clouds will reflect 90% of the incoming sunlight. It won't reach the dark ocean. It will allow the Arctic to cool. This buys us time to do leg one, slash emissions. We also need to implement carbon dioxide removal techniques, CDR. That's as simple as don't chop down forests, plant more trees, stimulate phytoplankton growth in the ocean by bringing up nutrients from below, all of these type of things. There's many other schemes for this as well, to remove carbon. I mean, there's about a dozen startup companies that are looking at building machines to directly take carbon from the atmosphere. There's ideas of biochar, you know, store carbon and then store it in the soils. The soils are a huge depository of carbon. So, you know, if you don't have any of these, if you're missing one of these legs, then the stool is unstable and toppled over.
So you're talking about, you know, what's up? Is my mic on?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, I think I'm not sure I'm actually going on over there. So you're talking about geoengineering, which is known popularly as geoengineering. And
yes, the dreaded that's a geoengineering
very,
word.
Very, very controversial. And up until recently, I was extremely reluctant to even think about that because of the, mm-hmm. I'm very reluctant to put things back in the hands of the same people who've gotten us into this mess, which is large yeah. centralized organizations. And, thinking that maybe we could use the profit motive in the interests of climate change. These are all extremely large and complex questions. But I personally, at this point, I'm not a nihilist, I guess, as it were. I do value life on planet Earth. I don't, you know, I'm not completely wedded to it. I guess, you know, whatever happens will happen. And we're going to have to just accept our fate if it comes to that. But you know, if it is possible to, you know, maintain some sort of stability within the climate system so that, you know, maybe we can finally figure the these issues of hierarchy and war and conflict and dominance out, that would be great. Anyway, let's leave those considerations for just a second because I'd like to respect the callers that have been waiting patiently. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the show.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
My question is about the lack of study and outreach of that information from the latitudes that you live in and what you're talking about, permafrost. And I wonder, since I'm like most people who pay attention, we're aware of permafrost melt and the methane, big deal, and it's a huge deal. But you're saying something new. You're saying that those amounts aren't really being taken into account at all in the world conversation and scientific conversation. That's pretty scary. And I wonder if, it's about latitude. It's about your latitude, and it's also about Siberian latitude. So what sort of work has been done with Russian and Nordic scientists? Thank you.
Yes, this is a great question. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they do these reports, the last one every 7 years or so. The last one was in 2013. And but that data in 2013, it's about 4 years old. Like, so researcher will do a study, then might take a year, then it might take a year back and forth to get it peer reviewed and accepted with revisions, and then it has to be in the literature for 2 years for the IPCC to publish it. And, you know, so this whole idea of the IPCC and their reports assumes that methane will stay in place and not significantly come out from the Earth system and affect the climate. And I think the data is clearly showing that this is not the case. Most of the work in the permafrost until more recently has been done in Russia and the previous Soviet Union. Lots of work done by Russian people on ships going out to the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf for the last 30 years, doing cores, measuring methane in the cores, measuring the methane bubbling up. In fact, there was a report in 2010 that the methane was bubbling up in diameters of 10 to 20 meter sort of regions. And then a year later, it was hundreds of meters and kilometers, and the rate of methane was coming up a lot. The rate of methane in the Arctic is being measured by satellite data to be very, very large and increasing. Just last week, the numbers in the upper atmosphere reached over 3,000 parts per billion, whereas the overall level in the atmosphere, the average is about 1,800, which is, you know, much, much higher than it has been for the last million years. As measured from ice cores, it's varied between 350 and 700 parts per billion, and now we're 1,850 rising, and a measurement was 3,000. It's definitely coming up, and it's a very powerful greenhouse gas. It's not 25 times worse than CO2. On a 20-year timescale, it's 86 times worse than CO2. On a 100-year timescale, which I always quote, it's 34 times. I mean, this is the IPCC report, yet media always gets this wrong and downplays that number. It's insane. On a few-year timescale, which is the important number, if it comes up in the Arctic and sticks around for a while, is 150 or 200 times worse than CO2. So, you know, it's like an extremely powerful greenhouse gas. Now, there was a review paper on permafrost methane, and the view is that if the temperature of that region rises about 1.5 degrees, then this is sort of a threshold where the methane emissions start coming up rapidly. And, you know, with Arctic temperature amplification, we're already, you know, very close. I mean, we're already very close or even exceeding that. So what are the implications? You know, what have we seen? Well, in Siberia, which has warmed a lot faster than Alaska even, we've seen these big blowholes appear in the permafrost in certain regions around the Yamal Peninsula. And these large blowholes, some of them are extremely large, and they've measured, found at least 20 plus of these. And what's happening is the heat is getting down and melting the methane class rates. The methane class rates, it's frozen water surrounding a methane molecule. And when the water melts, that methane trapped in the center is released, and the whole volume of this expands about 160 or 180 times, something like that. So that's happening under the ground. The pressure is building up, and it's causing the ground to lift up and give way in the case of these Siberian blowholes. Recently, it's being confirmed that in the Kara Sea, this has been happening on the seafloor. There's been mounds appearing on the seafloor, which is from the buildup of this methane. More important to keep in mind is off New Zealand, on some of the continental shelves off New Zealand, there's structures on the seafloor that are up to 100 kilometers in diameter. And it's believed that the cause of these structures was a methane release, a large rapid methane release at some point in the past. And they can try to get dates and things. So, you know, a picture is emerging that, you know, methane, I mean, there's a book called The Methane Class Rate Gun by Kennett from a number of years ago, which is a very interesting read on that. So, you know, the idea of this is a huge risk. Even if the risk is low, if we get lots of methane coming out, it will affect the entire planet. So risk is the probability of something happening times the impact. And the entire planet's a pretty big impact.
So I want to bracket that thought and get back to that. And perhaps Leslie, who's our next caller, might be have a question on the same in the same vein. Go ahead, Leslie. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I'm actually calling about Solar City in Nevada and the huge tax that was passed on consumers there that chose to put solar panels on their home that basically has shut Solar City down. I wanted to get your feedback on that. Yeah, looking at, the Solar City cut 550 Nevada jobs. It's a new net metering rate.
Are you familiar with that, Paul?
Well, I can comment on it, yes. I mean, I understand that, I mean, the renewable industry is growing in leaps and bounds. Net metering is a very good way to reduce, to cause greater energy efficiency, because when you have higher rates, you know, when, like, the cost of electricity, it varies per second, literally. Depending on supply and demand, you know, which changes throughout the day. I mean, the demand is always changing and the supply tries to follow because we don't have good storage mechanisms for it. So this is what the natural gas power plants do. You know, you can fire them up quickly, shut them down quickly, or like hydro, you know, let more water through, reduce water. So you price things differently. When the demand is the highest, you have the highest price. And that way you try to, you know, you save yourself from building new power plants and you kind of level out the load. So, but there is opposition to a lot of these things, and just follow the money. I mean, you know, it's been in the press recently that the Koch brothers have this vendetta against renewable energy and against energy efficiency. Of course, their business model is selling fossil fuels. So the more that people use, the better for them, right? So this is a case of, I call it, you know, post-democracy. I mean, who's really in charge? Is it the governments that we elect, or is it people that lobby them and pay money to them and, you know, seem to have great control over them? I mean, we're seeing this in these super PACs and things in elections, you know, the amount of money being spent by, you know, special interest groups. I wouldn't call the fossil fuel industry a special interest group. I would call them the controlling factor in our present-day society. So, I mean, you know, like it seems this is part of the twilight zone. We live in a world where, you know, doing the right thing it's really hard to do the right thing because there's groups that want us to do things that will favor their business.
That gets into the you know, as I mentioned, that it's all connected, and that you talk about, you know, the current election in your new YouTube video. So, you know, of course, you know, the spectacle of Donald Trump becoming the front runner of the Republican Party is just part of this. I don't know, my brother in Alaska, who actually is a botanist and is actually, you know, involved in some climate change studies himself, and he's following your work as well. But he has this idea that there's almost this sort of a balancing factor, social balancing factor, where the extremity of what's actually happening leads to this sort of like extremity of denial. It's sort of this, I don't know, there's a psychosocial sphere in which these forces, I don't know, maybe there's somebody who's actually studying this. And so, you know, Trump is a great climate denier. And maybe it's exactly because the cognitive dissonance is so high, the inability to actually recognize how bad we've screwed up, how much the model that these people are depending on is totally screwing up the life on this planet Earth, and the inability to actually recognize that fact and to redouble their efforts to deny that fact. That's my take on it.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I would argue that, you know, it sort of comes down to, you know, who the public sort of respects for information. Like, I think it used to be that, you know, before the ability of people to carry around like a supercomputer in their pocket, I'm talking about like an iPhone or something, you know, compare it to a supercomputer from not that many years ago, it's more powerful. You know, and we have the information at our fingertips, but then we need filters, like what is the information that is valid, what isn't, what are we being fed, you know, what's propaganda, what's reality. You know, it's becoming much harder for people to tell. And I guess the so-called knowledge of so-called experts is sort of under attack because, you know, people think that they can become experts or they are experts in things that they know very little about just because they can go and get the information. But there's a big difference between information and wisdom or understanding and putting the jigsaw puzzle together, if you like. So science, right now we're having a massive tug of war in societies around the world, in countries around the world, between science on the one hand and ideology, or, you know, call it fundamentalism, or, you know, religious fundamentalism or ideology. And the, you know, it's almost like, you know, the science is saying, you know, climate change is a problem. You know, it's a real problem. Here's how the changes are occurring. Here's how we measure them. Here's how the atmosphere, we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere. Here's how we've changed the chemistry of the ocean. Here's what's happening. And on the other hand, like to deny it is a choice, right? It's the choice to, it's like blinders to just not let that information into your brain. And you can look at human psychology. You know, you can look at the amygdala and the fear and flight response, and, you know, the human brain is sort of not wired it's wired to look at immediate threats, like the idea of terrorism, you know, that strikes fear into people, and yet the risk of being killed by a terrorist in the U.S. is less than that of being killed by a toddler, because the toddler reaches into mom's handbag, grabs out the gun and you know, shoots the mom or somebody else. And this happened, more people die in the country, in the U.S., from that than from terrorists, you know, over the years. The same as a vending machine falling on you. We don't have a homeland security against toddlers. We don't have a homeland security against vending machines. And yet those risks are high. But even though those risks are high, you know, it's heart disease, it's traffic accidents, it's car accidents. These are the risks, and people just don't assess these risks properly, right? So, it's really time for people to kind of wake up. And the extreme weather events that are in your face, you know, forests are dying, we have crops wiped out, we have cities taken out by flooding. I call it the climate casino. You know, a city draws a bad card in the climate casino. There's torrential rain, it's flooded out. What city's going to be next, you know, sort of thing. So you can explain these things, a lot of these things, by, you know, looking at the overall system and how the pieces fit together in the science, or you can say, oh, it's all an act of God, there's nothing we can do, it's all changing, and, you know, happily go on with whatever you're doing.
Okay, well, I'm going to... I just want to give up. We only have about a little over 10 minutes left, and we have a couple callers.
Okay.
And
really quick answers. I'll do as little talking as I can.
Okay, and we'll have you back on again. I if you want. I think it's important.
Yeah, sure. Anytime you want.
Okay,
yeah.
So let's go to Sunny.
Hi. Good morning. What an important discussion. Really, the climate casino. Truly, I mean, thank you, and thank you, KBOO. Daytime public affairs programming, always excellent. Thank you. I was going to ask what would a life look like for a person that is actually starting to address these things? And the other thing is the seduction of it's all going to go up in smoke, and then we're going to be delivered to a brand new place that we can wreck. along with consumerism, you know, they don't want people to think too much about the consequences of what they're purchasing and what they're eating, because it's such a big party for everybody. So what would a day look like if a person were living the right way? And then the last thing I have to add real quickly, we're trying to start a community that will be sustainable emotionally and for the planet, emotionally for people and for the planet. And Sunday, 1 o'clock, Pioneer Square, downtown Starbucks, if there are people that want to start working on this, meet me at 1 o'clock downtown Pioneer Starbucks. We have a couple of space opportunities where there will be gardening opportunity and hopefully a more happier, sustainable life. But I didn't really want to put that in, but it's just a good time opportunity. This is what we're going to be working on, all the stuff that you're discussing. And so what would a day look like? What changes do I need to make right now as an individual that will just start helping?
Okay, thank you, Sunny.
Thank you.
Okay, well, this isn't a science issue. This isn't a technology issue. This is a human behavior, human understanding issue. So the more people know about what's happening, the more connections people can make with extreme weather to climate change. That's the first thing. So then if the problem is, if you don't recognize the problem, then you don't have to do anything, right, in your mind. So if you recognize the problem, then what can you do? Well, the biggest thing, like I say, it's a human thing. So, we need a global carbon tax. The global carbon tax, that is increased over time, started off really low and increase it over time. How do we ever arrive at that? Well, don't call it a tax. People hate that word. Call it a fee, carbon fee and dividend. Look up the group Citizens Climate Lobby, join a group like that. Lots of like-minded people who are very concerned about the problem, and they lobby all politicians, of all different political stripes, saying, we need a fee on carbon, put a price on carbon and return, pool that money together and return it to people on a per capita basis. And people that don't use much carbon, if you live in an apartment, you don't drive a car, you make money every year from this.
Well, I think Sunny was also getting to just sort of more immediate things. And of course, I could say
immediate things.
Well, let me just give a crack at it, because we also have Nigel waiting in the wings. And I never gave out the number, but it's probably too late now. But anyways, 503-231-8187. My apologies to anybody listening who doesn't already know the KBOO studio
number.
Okay, let
number. Me make a quick suggestion.
Okay.
People can email you their questions, a couple lines, their question. You email it to me. This is callers who can't get in and call, and I'll try to answer it, in the next few hours and get the email back to you, and you can get it back to people. So
okay.
That's people who want to call or dying to call and just aren't able to get in the time constraints.
Well, thank you. That's an excellent suggestion. And my my KBOO email address, or it's not actually a KBOO address, but it's it's Paul R. KBOO, PaulRKBOO @gmail.com. And I'll repeat that, PaulRKBOO @gmail.com. If you have a question for Paul Beckwith, who's a climatologist from Ottawa, Canada. So let's have more conversations about this. All I can say is, there's the activist way to go, which is, there's 350 PDX, there's Rising Tide, there's the big national groups that their local offices that are working on these issues. There's the Climate Action Coalition here in Portland. There's just, your own carbon footprint. There's talking to your friends, neighbors, colleagues, all these things.
Everybody has different skills, right? Everybody has different skills, different strengths. So just figure out what you are, what you really enjoy doing, and try to figure out, how you can make a difference. And, join, talk with other people. A lot of this stuff, you need a shoulder to cry on occasionally. I just created a fairly new website, paulbeckwith.net, and I put all my videos there. I find the best way for me is I like talking to people on videos and showing information. So, it's going to be a bit different for each person, but like I say, it's not a science thing. It's not even an engineering thing. It's a human behavior thing, and I'm pretty sure we're nearing a tipping point where public is going to go from, I don't care about climate change, to, I'm terrified of climate change. It's not going to go, and then it will hopefully go back to a level where, okay, we got a problem here. What do we do? Houston, we have a problem.
right? And we, you know, we figure out how to fit a round hole into a round object into a square hole, you know, or vice versa in Apollo 13. And, you know, we start doing this. There can be tremendous growth, you know, with renewable energy. It can be a technological resurgence, you know. So these things are being forced upon us.
So
by the climate.
So let's go to Nigel real quick. We only have a few minutes left. Go ahead, Nigel.
Hi. I have two very brief questions. One pertains to climate change, and the other question is something else entirely. I wonder if may I ask that?
Go ahead.
Sure.
The other day, within the past 48 hours, David Duke endorsed Trump, and then Trump responded in some way by saying something, I don't know what the context was. He quoted Mussolini. Could you clarify what happened?
We may not be able to get into that, but
yeah.
No, he tweeted a Mussolini quote saying better to live as a one day as a lion than 100 years as a sheep or something. And then he refused to back down when it was pointed out that it was actually a Mussolini quote. He says, who cares? You know, he likes to be known for good quotes rather than. But anyway, so that's the context of that. What's your first question?
Yeah, the first question is, so I hear experts on both sides about climate change. One side says it's a hoax. The other side, it's not. I kind of vaguely get the impression that the zillionaire oil tycoons have bought the people who say it's a hoax. Do you think that might be accurate?
Yes, absolutely. And it's like one or two people out of 100 people. Mostly it's experts in a different field. You know, it's experts say a geologist.
Martinis, you know, they screw everybody else, screw the next generation.
Yeah.
What sort of human beings? It's like they're subhuman.
Yes, it's absolutely fraudulent, and it should be criminal, and it should be treated that way too.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, I think it has to be nipped in the bud. Listen, thank you very much.
Okay.
I'd suggest,
go ahead.
We need to convert Guantanamo to a climate change training school, and we need to send most of the congressmen in the Republican Party there to have a crash course in, you know, climate change, and they write a test at the end to get out or something. I mean, they're wrecking our future. They're literally wrecking our future. It's amazing they can get away with it and have been for so long. I mean, they'll follow the money, you know.
The key is to get into the position where we can actually have control of Guantanamo. And of course, I'm not sure I would actually want to have control of Guantanamo, which gets into a whole whole other conversation.
There's a bit of a joke.
Yeah, I know.
A bit of dark humor there, of course.
Yes. No, I agree with that kind of dark humor. My previous favorite one was, you know, that, you know, we need to put Dick Cheney and the like into, you know, shoveling manure from, you know, pig farms or something like that. Let's get back into this issue, you know, really briefly. You know, you talked about the three-legged stool and the issue of geoengineering. And I know in 2 minutes it's impossible, but, you know, what you're really talking about, you know, obviously is the kind of revolutionary transformation that Bernie Sanders supposedly is talking about. And I think to some extent he is. You know, but it's a massive, you know, people talk about like a similar to a Manhattan Project or a World War II mobilization. And really what you're talking about is something on that scale, but we're still not almost at square one. It seems to me, again,
it's not all that complicated, okay? If the U.S. military continues to say that climate change is the biggest threat to humanity, which I've heard some people say, then let's put our money where that view is, and let's take the $700 billion a year for the military budget. Let's get all those engineers and scientists. Instead of designing things to kill other people, we've got enough. Let's figure out how to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. Let's figure out how to cool the Arctic and greatly ramp up renewables and solve this problem, you know, in 10 years or so. Treat it as a an emergency, which I think it's going to happen sooner or later. You know, I think a blue ocean event will turn people to terror, you know, about climate change, and then that will happen. So why wait? Do it sooner.
And that could be happening sooner than we think. Let's look at what happens this summer. So thank you so much, Paul Beckwith, climatologist from Ottawa, Canada. We got to get out of here. We'll have you back on the air. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much.
And good morning. It is just a few seconds before 9 a.m. and you are tuned. KBOO Portland. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, host Kathleen Stevenson welcomes Peter Neal of the World Ocean Observatory and author of The Once and Future Ocean, Notes Toward a New Hydraulic Society. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, news, views, and interviews with hosted by Chris Andre. At 10:15, on Flashpoints, today's show, we have more excerpts from the documentary film Capitalism. And then at 11 today, it's The Bike Show. They will welcome guests Kimball Taylor and Lorenz J. Finneson, who explore how bicycles carve their mark, from Tijuana immigrants to Boston movers and shakers. Thank you, KBOO members and listeners who make this radio station thrive. If you are not already a member, you can become one by visiting our website at kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today in the top right corner.